sitting and doing at it. Some volunteer who would like to cite the question we should deal with tonight. Who would like to do it? First question to Bob Arnott.
Well, what's the relationship between the exercises that took place and the forces that are worked on by hidden persuaders? Is there any relationship?
What is the relation between the forces we experiment with and those in hidden persuaders?
I felt that those are forces that are ever present, that people are not aware of. And those forces drive people. If you bring them out in the exercise, you're actually gaining control of them.
Yes.
Is that so?
Quite so. There's a coming to be of an individual. In all these diagrams, you must remember the other circles that overlap continuously. And to keep the diagram simple, we've just drawn one of these circles, which has come to be within the infinite, but the infinite is sentient power, is vibrating continuously, and the result is that any given finite being is traversed with motions, and these motions lay down a geometrical pattern, so that the totality of all the formal possibilities of experience is actually present in every finite being. Imagine then a being full of vibrations, and we'll pretend for a moment all the vibrations are equal, so that the effective drawing of this being shows a grid in equal stress. Now, we could say that that is the wisdom sphere for any given being. But that wisdom is equally stressed form. The total geometrical possibilities of the sphere in equal stress we will call wisdom. The dome of the whiz, we'll put an aspirate in it for fun and spell it slightly differently. The dome is the sphere itself, and the whiz, or IHVS, or Vishiv function, means the power, sentient, moving to produce this dome. So the sentient power endomes itself and becomes a wisdom sphere. And I put wish dome here because the total formal processes of the sphere contain the forms of all possible wishes that the individual can have. But if they're in complete equilibrium, nothing happens. So that the wisdom sphere itself is a sphere embracing the formal possibilities totally of the sphere, and thus including all the possible actions that any individual may perform. But in the absence of some disequilibrating force, the thing cannot develop. The wisdom sphere will remain at the level of wisdom, but it will never become knowledge. Knowledge implies, in the K, the stimulus. A stimulus that comes in a now. It's a knowledge. When the stimulus comes in a given now, a definite amount of energy enters the wisdom sphere and disequilibrates it. Now this moment of disequilibration is the same thing as an act of perception. We can say that every act of perception is a moment of disequilibrium. And the moment of the arising of serial knowledge is the moment of the disturbance of your wisdom sphere. So that if the stimulus is very strong, your wisdom disappears and is displaced by knowledge. And we'll call knowledge the superstress on a part of the wisdom sphere, and this superstress partializes the content of consciousness and makes the being partial. If the stimulus is pleasant, we say the being is partial to the stimulus. But if it's unpleasant, the being is parted by it. He's still made partial. So if the stimulus is very strong, it induces a very strong superstress and overthrows the total equilibrium, and thus destroys the wisdom and displaces it with knowledge. There is a distortion introduced by the incoming energy of the stimulus. Now, whenever a stimulus comes in, it comes in with a definite amount of energy, and it has to reach threshold value actually to penetrate that sphere. When it gets inside, it is either easily assimilable or not. If the energy is insufficient to produce a change in the wisdom sphere, then you are unaware of the stimulus. You say, in fact, you've had no stimulus. You are indifferent. But if the energy inserted in the stimulus comes in at a certain rate, not too strong, not too weak, you experience pleasure. You can assimilate it easily, at leisure. But if we increase the rate of the energy input beyond a certain level, it actually starts to threaten to disrupt the equilibrium violently. And whenever such threat occurs, there is experienced pain, that is refusal of the incoming energy, fear, and rounded various levels of anxiety. Let's imagine for a moment this is a mono cell. A very strong stimulus comes in, enters into it with great violence, and actually destroys a portion of the protoplasm. This will represent by black. When we're chasing the record content of a person in the Henriade pursuit, we often find the person saying, "There is nothing here, it is black." And they make this statement about black. We know there's something there worth chasing, because they say it is black. Black means it has been destroyed. Now imagine here's a portion of the protoplasm that has been destroyed. But in being destroyed, it has absorbed some of the incoming energy. Now let's cut this thing with the grid and say this is now a human egg, which in the process of mitosis has cut itself into many, many cells. One of the cells here is killed. It is black. It is really killed. It is destroyed. It can't function. Too much energy has been applied to it. But in the act of killing that cell, the incoming energy has been partially absorbed. Around it, there are some other cells. And these cells feel under threat. They are grey. They know that something on the inside of them, something on the inside of them has been destroyed. They know that they themselves are under threat, and yet they are not killed. Now, round here, there's another row of cells. And this row of cells can feel apprehension on the inside of them. They get the vibrational state of the grey ones, and they can feel that something is wrong inside. They don't know that anybody has been killed, that the cell that received the stimulus, but they do know that something awful has gone on inside there. Now around here there are another group of cells, and these cells are vaguely anxious about something, but they don't know what, and they don't even know in which direction it lies, because the energy isn't sufficiently intense to destroy them or really to upset them. So they have a vague, undefined state of anxiety. Now, the next row of cells around here have an even vaguer state, symbolized by the How are you feeling, William? Will you come over here a minute, William? Can you come over here? Across. diagram here has actually triggered off the process inside, and it's a very, very common one, because very, very deeply inside all of us, there are damages that we have suffered. The original cell may be destroyed. The cells next to it know that that destruction has taken place, but they're not destroyed, but they are in contact with the fact of death next door. So they themselves are terribly scared of that death, and they shout out, "We are in danger of dying," because something has died on the inside here. Next to them are another row of cells who are aware that these are shouting something has died. They don't know what. And so their degree of fear is less intense than this grey row. Black and grey are very common words to come out to people when they are getting near to the particular point of damage. Now, as we're moving away from the actually destroyed cell, we come across rows and rows of cells with progressively less intense fear upon them. But there's always some motion from this point of damage spreading through the being. We put our centre of imminent spirit, which is never penetrated by those motions, and is never damaged, nor is it damageable. But in the rest of the being, in the whole of what we may call the somatic zone, if we call this the psyche inside here, then from this inner ring to the outer perimeter, we can call soma, the body, the soul. Through the soma goes some vibration from the destroyed cells, and it travels all through this somatic zone, and the word used to cover it by the existentialists is the word zorga. Now, this zorga is a background concern. There is no existential individual without concern for existence in its soma. Its body as such, its protoplasm, is concerned because it has been injured. And the vibrations of this injury are traversing it, and they continue to do so throughout the whole of individual life, unless the person, through a process of inner education, becomes aware of the immanent spirit and identifies with it totally. The only rescue from this concern is identifying with spirit. And apart from that, the whole soma is swept continuously with motions of concern. If then we start to work on ourselves, we become aware that the observer is not the observed, that the psyche is not the soma, that the psyche is the embodied spirit. The spirit has ensouled itself by rotating, that this observer is not the observed. When we become aware of this, we are prepared to dare to enter consciously zones of pain, zones of destruction, zones of death, and so on. Now, in the case of hidden persuaders, the commercialists who know that the soma is reactive because of pain utilize the findings of the conditioned reflex theory, which deals only with the soma and not with the psyche as such, nor with spirit at all. And what they do is examine statistically the basic concerns or anxieties of the human race. When they have learned what these are, they deliberately play upon them. And they are attacking by external stimulus the soma and inducing motions in the soma, which they know have resonances with engram patterns of pain and so on. So they're related to to the work we do in this sense. They attack from the outside the soma with the intention of re-stimulating fears to force the person into an extroverted reaction. We become reflexively self-conscious and then enter into the zones in the soma consciously in order to discover, to take the lid off the pain zones, to penetrate to their meaning, to discharge locked emotion from them, and thus to gain freedom. So the hidden persuaders and the work we do are exactly opposite. The commercialists, using the reflex theories, are stimulating people deliberately to force them into entirely mechanical reactions, and we are penetrating into these somatic zones and the engram patterns in order to discharge the emotion from them, because when this emotion is totally discharged, then one is not reactive at all to any stimulus whatever and cannot be triggered off into a banging commodity we don't want. Now, let's have again another look at this problem. There is a finite being. In the center of that being, to which the rotating energies cannot enter, is the immanent spirit. That immanent spirit, insofar as it is circumscribed, is called soul. The soul itself is a sentient power. It is the essentially identical power with the absolute sentient power. But being circumscribed, it has between itself and the transcendent spirit a zone of action, an action band, and this action band is the soma, your body. And it is this somatic reaction band that is being aimed at by the hidden persuaders. They know it is charged with pains, and they are determined to utilize that fact to force reactive behavior, to buy commodities, determine the next war, and so on. It is here then possible to illustrate in a very simple way. Too much energy coming in creates a pain zone. Reactively, the cells round about it try to stop it spreading. The kind of reaction that encloses a pain zone reactively is one that we can say is entirely mechanical, is not controlled, is quite automatic, and creates a zone of unconsciousness, which by the nature of any closure is a zone of turbulence. That's the turba of Burma. Now, if that zone is not entered consciously, it remains a permanently reactive center. But if we become aware that the observer is not the observed, we identify with the observer, we can take consciousness from our center and deliberately penetrate through to it. The method of getting to it is always the same. We look for something we don't like. We know in principle that if we don't like it, we've been injured in the past. But we also know that if we don't like it, we must have survived it. If we've survived it, we must have had enough strength to absorb the energy. We have an unpleasant zone, but if we can experience it and have enough energy reactively to wall it in, we've had enough strength to survive, and therefore, no matter how unpleasant it is, no matter how much it shouts, "I'm going to die," which is the usual cry from this zone, we know that because we have survived so far with it locked up, we can dare to go into that zone. We can actually enter into it, see the unpleasantness, the death, the fears, the anxieties, and the general concern sweeping the being. We can enter it consciously. When we do so and see the form of the situation, every time we enter in, a little bit of the energy comes out, and it is then less and less turbulent, until finally it settles down into a state in which everybody going through the process says, "Well, I just don't want to go through it anymore because there's nothing in it. It's now boring to enter this zone because I know all about it." It's lost its meaning. Now, we can say this, that emotion equals life, life force. Emotion and interest are two words for the same kind of behavior of power. If you destroy emotion, you destroy interest. If you destroy both of these, or the two aspects of the one they represent, the life force diminishes. In the state of deep apathy or unfeelingness, there's no interest in anything, there's no emotion about anything. Emotion is outmotion. It means that forces are coming from the inside and moving out. Now, when we come to look at the threefold man, with his head and his chest and his belly, we can divide each of these three parts into three again. And the hidden persuaders are concerned to utilize the locked up emotion in people and to create interest to force the life pattern in a direction profitable to the commercialists. Now, if we take the belly region and cut it into three zones, we can say that in the lowest zone of all, that is sexual energy. In the middle zone, that is the navel energy of belongingness. And in the top part of this bottom zone, there is simply the appetite for food. So we have an urge to eat, an urge to belong, and an urge to sexual relation. Now, we know that down in the belly, the person is blind. That is to say, he does not logically decide what to do. This urge is an urge. It just pushes along regardless. By its very nature, it's determined to move, and it loves the feeling of overcoming a resistance, because the resistance overcome is the evidence of its power. So, down in the belly land, we have an urge to eat in the stomach, an urge to belong in the navel, and in the lower part, an urge to sex. These three basic urges are the three that are most strongly attacked by the hidden persuaders. Most people would like to be sexually potent. Most people like to belong to a family, a tribe, or a nation. And most people like to eat. And because they have the urge to eat, they must have a fear that there's nothing to eat. Because they have the urge to belong, they must fear isolation. Because they have fear that they may become impotent, arising out of their urge to sex, it is possible to attack them. There are three levels here, and in the positive and negative phases, people can be triggered. You can do the carrot and stick on the donkey. You put the carrot before its nose, you offer it sex, participation in social functions, and plenty to eat. Or you threaten it with the deprivation of these things. The BO ad says you can't get a girl, you smell. You see, the same thing extended on the middle level says you are not socially acceptable because your hair oil is the wrong perfume. And the same thing says you are not acceptable because you don't know how to eat. You can't tell a fish knife from a butter knife. So. Now, if we look at these positively, you see that the urge to eat must follow the carrot. All the advertisements that show food in glorious technicolor. They are using the positive side of the urge. They're saying, you want to eat, and here is something to eat. It looks marvelous. The urge to belong shows people very often in the Bahamas in evening clothes enjoying themselves, high society, and belong to the best people, positively. And the urge to sex shows, as it's in a car ad or a cigarette ad, that if you've got the right brand, you've got the right girl, they go together. In the positive phases, they're very easy to see. In the negative phases, they're equally easy to see, because all you do is prefix them with not. You cannot eat this. poisonous, or you cannot get this if you don't live at the appropriate level. You cannot eat this, caviar or something, unless your income is high enough and you know the right kind of people who eat it. You can't belong unless you know how to belong. You need a handbook of belonging. And there's a handbook that tells you how to fit in at a party and so on. And in the case of sex, you need a little handbook that tells you of all the errors you mustn't commit. Now you can see that because these three urges exist down here in their positive and negative phases, then any person who understands that they exist can start dividing his vocabulary. Quite simply, the words he's got can be examined carefully, and all those to do with eating can be put together, all those to do with belonging can be put together, all those to do with sex can be put together. And then you can construct an advertisement or a piece of propaganda rich in the particular words that you want to trigger people off with. You know that men are riddled with the fear of impotence as they reach a certain age. You know that young people going to parties are very much influenced by this fear that they can't fit in with the party. And you know that many of them are motivated by eating, even if it's only black men do chocolates. Here then, we see that the hidden persuaders can act upon us insofar as we are not able to control our vocabulary. If we can't control our vocabulary, simply if we can't control the words we've got in our heads, to do with eating and belonging and sex, then we are reactive to them. Remember, we have two vocabularies, and we should have only one. The two vocabularies are passive, the words we cannot define, and active, the words we can define. The words we can actively define are brought into the cortex up here, and they are made available for ourselves to cause our own reactions. Whereas the words of our passive vocabulary do not get in there, they've gone in the ears and they've gone into an emotional centre, and then they're sunk down into the belly very early in life, so that the mere use of a word can upset a person. For instance, the use of the word sex produces a peculiar resonance in the mind. If you don't see that the word sex is the same as the word sex, cutting things into sections, then you start reacting unconsciously at an urge level as if there's something very peculiar about it, something drivy, something primitive. But if you see that sex is the mode whereby an A is sectioned, you alter the feeling tone of the word. Now, it's a simple experiment. Look at the word sex with S-E-X and feel inside yourselves what happens. Feel the response to the word sex. Now, if I put over it a drawing of a man and a woman, and look at the word sex with those two symbols, notice the change in the emotional tone. Now, let's re-spell it. S-E-C-T-S, sex. And notice that immediately the emotional tone changes. You notice, incidentally, in some of the seven dialects, that in the middle of the word, an intrusive T tends to appear. You get it in the Cockney, a T that comes in the middle of a word. If you hear it, it tends to produce different associations. The word sex has to do with a taboo subject, and the word sects has to do with subdivisions of religions. Now, if you look at the two words and feel inside yourself, you will find that you have different emotional responses to those two words. And yet, basically, those two words have the same root. And therefore, basically, you shouldn't respond to the one any more than you do to the other. But if you do, you're subject to the hidden persuaders. If I say sex in a conversation, certain people, they wiggle on their chairs. When if I said to them, I'm terribly sorry, I meant religious sects, then they think I've said sects, and they get a different emotional response. So you see, even in a simple word like that, you have definite evidence inside yourself as soon as you feel that you are emotively reactive to a verbal stimulus. Now in the same way, all the other words in your vocabulary can be placed on basics. Now, notice this threefold division here, sex, belonging, and eating. If we shift these three up into the head, then we would place at the back of the head, we'll place the infant profile alone, at the back of the head we would place the sex, then the belonging in the middle, and then the eating at the front. Now, eating in the head level is the same thing as perceiving. Percepts are food for thought. And in the middle region of the brain, there are special groups of cells that deal with belonging, the emotional feeling. And this belonging is in the heart, the chest level. This sex is in the belly level, and this eating of percepts is in the forebrain. So again, you can begin to divide the words pertaining to ideas in the same manner. Eating, that's taking in percepts. Belonging, grouping those percepts. And sex, analyzing those percepts. Sectioning them. So the same basic trinity down here, shifted up into the head, becomes a functional trinity of the intellectual order. And exactly the same thing happens in the middle region again. We'll take the right side and put sex, we'll put belonging in the middle, and on the right we'll put the eat. On the sinister side, I should say. Now, the basic urges from below, sex up to the right, the primary drive, eating up to the left, and the navel up to the middle. In the emotional life, belongingness is in the heart. The analytical process is in the left side of the chest, where it is absorbing the feelings, it's eating them bit by bit. But the analytical process of sex, where it's sectioning them in order to perceive the differences between them, is in the right side. So the right side is more active and cuts into the situation with feelings, and those feelings are aggressive. Feelings of aggression are sectioning feelings. And feelings of absorption are eating feelings. You want to take the person into you. You want to cut the person out of you on the opposite side. And you want simply to belong. And you want that person to belong to you. So again, your feeling has three phases. In the middle, the simple belongingness. What's yours is mine and what's mine is yours. And on the next side, the aggressive feeling that cuts into what people are doing. And on the other side, the simple absorption of the feelings from other people. So we get a threefold division again within each section of the threefold man, giving nine divisions. And of course the tenth now is the coordinator. So the fourth is the tenth. You remember this one of Pythagoras. 1 + 2 = 3 + 3 + 4 = 10. Now ten tended to hold, this holding, the ordinal perfection of the system. If we count 1, 2, 3 in the threefold man, then the spinal link is 4. And if we divide them all into 3, 3, 6, 9, then the spinal link is 10. And this is why one of the Greek philosophers said to another, what comes after 1, 2, 3, 4? And one said 5, and the other said, no, 10. He was thinking in a different way. He was saying, if you get your three parts coordinated, and then you reanalyze them into 3, you can write it down as 10, ordinal perfection. The ordinal perfection in the man arises when you are aware that every part of the three old man has three parts within it. As you become conscious of this, you can begin to liberate yourself from the trigger situations presented by the external world. And remember our old tag, to whom the good. Every time you see somebody putting something forward, no matter what it is, the correct question you should ask, to whom the good? Somebody is saying it. They're not saying it for nothing. They're saying it for something. Somebody is going to get the benefit. You want to know who. Or whom. Now let's have a look again at the man. A man has five senses. And he has a common sense to coordinate the five. Inside that he has an intellect. And inside that he has his immanent spirit, his initiative self, his inner self. Now, a man can place the absence of consciousness anywhere he likes in his being. And where he habitually places it, there will be the center that determines what kind of a benefit. So if a man places himself in the intellect and makes a statement out of that, that statement is benefiting the intellect. It's an intellectual statement, and every part of the organism witnesses itself. So when a statement comes out of an individual, you should say, what center in him is saying this? And to find out what center, you say, what center gets the benefit of it if I believe it? So if a man places himself in the five senses and then recommends something, he's only recommending the activity of the five senses. Enjoyment of that function. If he stands in the zone of common sense and speaks, he'll talk about common sense, and only common sense will get the benefit. If he stands in the intellect, only the intellect will get the benefit. And if he stands in the immanent spirit, when he speaks, the immanent spirit will get the benefit. But the important thing is to know that any individual man can and does have a general stress accent somewhere in his organism, that this is subject to periodic change according to cyclic law, and therefore the things that come out of him are always benefiting some part of his organism. Let's restore ourselves to the threefold man and re-examine the same proposition. If a man speaks out of the lower belly, usually in wartime, and a voice comes out of the mouth here saying, lo, I may be dead tomorrow, the voice has come from below. All you have to say is, who gets the benefit if I believe it? And as soon as you've discovered who gets the benefit, what part of the organism gets the benefit, then you know who said it, namely the one who gets the benefit. Because in the doctrine of servants, a servant is always self-witnessing. Every being is self-witnessing, and therefore, as soon as you know who gets the benefit, you know who said it. So if a man, having become impotent physically, talks about the community of minds, you know that he's talking about the community of minds because that's the only level at which he can get a benefit. Therefore, when you ask yourself the question, who is getting the benefit of this statement? As soon as you have discovered who gets the benefit, you know who said it. And when you know the level from which that voice comes, consciously you can decide whether you're going to cooperate at that level or not. That's a matter for your personal will and direction. But if you don't know this fact, that these voices come from different levels, and that they shift about according to periodic law, within an individual, then you are reactive to the stimuli given to you by other people. The hidden persuaders can go to work on you if you don't know that every part of your organism has its own voice. You remember we said that nothing succeeds but that which loves your call. And every cell is loving its own function. The stomach loves one thing, The navel loves another, and the genitalia love another. The heart loves something, the right lung something, the left lung, the head something, and so on. The lips love something, the nostrils love something, the eyes do. An expression like the lust of the eyes in the Bible means what it says. Eyes actually enjoy looking at beautiful colours, so that they are reactive to colour. Ears enjoy harmonious sounds, so they're reactive to them. If you don't know that each part of your organism loves something and will move towards it if presented, or will shrink back in terror if you threaten it, then you are reactive to any person who knows those facts and can present you with the appropriate stimuli. We will repeat once more that we are dealing with exactly the same thing that the commercial hidden persuader men are dealing with. That they are dealing with it from outside and deliberately re-stimulating zones of fear and hope within the organism to provoke unconsidered reaction which displaces cash and property into other hands. Whereas it is our purpose to become reflexively self-conscious and to penetrate into the somatic zones and discover within them all the locked-up energies which would be reactive if they were left locked up. And this process of penetrating into them causes progressive release of the energies and an increase of freedom from the stimulus situation. And we can say that no man is free until, in fact, he is no longer reactive to an external stimulus situation. Whatever we do, in a situation from freedom, coming out of freedom will not be reactive and therefore will not be conditioned by the past. Notice the peculiar nature of the reaction. A reaction is only possible providing the person has been hurt in some measure. There must be a degree of hurt before a person is made reactive. The innocent are not reactive. But if a person gets hurt in even a small measure, he becomes reactive. So if he is reactive, there are zones of pain within him. To gain freedom is the same thing as to penetrate consciously into zones of pain. Now this is the affirmation of the cross again. If we like to put little zones of pain and mark them with the cross, we can do so. We are crucified in the body wherever we have endured a pain and then shut down on it because it is a pain. To release ourselves from the cross, to be resurrected, is to penetrate with consciousness into that private hell, that recorded zone of pain, and then to come out of that zone again into the light. Resurrection, then, is a possibility for every Sabbath that has endured pain. Resurrection can occur in parts of the organism every day. If you take the fact that the one cell divides itself into two cells, that the nucleus splits, and both halves get a bit, and it goes on dividing in the same way until it's a mass of little cells, each with its own nuclear intelligence, then any single cell is equivalent to the whole cell, or to any other cell. This means to say that if one of those cells suffers a pain, and is darkened by it, is killed by it, then it needs resurrecting. Resurrection can occur in part, and the time process is a process of the continuous generation of deaths, and if you are lucky and remember your immanent spirit, a continuous entry into deaths to make resurrection. So the whole man can die and be resurrected, and a part of the man can die and be resurrected. And because of the terrific amount of work needed, the terrific amount of energy needed to resurrect the whole man in one go. In fact, in the temporal process, he's resurrected in bits. If we can reclaim lost bits of ourselves that have been hurt, If we can reclaim one a day, we're doing very well. If we can reclaim the basic injuries that we've done within perhaps a year of work, then we are free to go on and look at our life more intelligently. But if we don't reclaim our basic zones of turbulence, if we don't resurrect them, then we are in fact being conditioned in all our work by their attitude. And it's very important at this point, if you are dealing with people at all who are in any way sick or negative, to recognize the high suggestibility of pain zones. Pain zones don't want to be opened. They don't want to. The immanent spirit would open them if it became reflexively aware. But there is resistance from the cells that have endured the hurt. So if you're dealing with a person and the person refuses to listen, it isn't the person who's refusing to listen, it is the zones of pain. So if somebody is debating a problem with you and you find resistance there, do not attribute it to the person. The person is never resistant. The intelligent person is intelligent, the resident intelligence within that soma, within that body, is never resisting those things which would restore its wholeness to it. But because of the nature of the pain zones, they are resistant to being opened because they put a wall around themselves because they were under attack. And they don't want to take the wall down because they hear from inside, I'm about to die. If I look at that thing, I will die, they say. We have to penetrate into those knowing that they resist. And we must never fall into the error of thinking that the person is resisting. Because if we do, we will generate personal animosity. Now, if you want to get out of relation with the person, you have created a new situation of pain. Remember our old diagram of two beings in relation. They can relate at the somatic level, body to body, by simple knocking against each other, or they can relate where A takes his intelligence and penetrates to the physical body of the other and stems its mode of reaction, and then A adjusts himself to B's mechanicality. Or both can penetrate to each other's immanent center of spiritual intelligence. Now, thou is the expression Martin Buber uses, thou. Each one is an I to itself and a thou to the other. I, thou, this I is thou to this I, and this thou is I to self. There's a relation I, thou from center to center. There's another relation I, it from center to the other being's body. And there's a relation it, body to body, pure mechanicality. Now, the worst error a psychiatrist could make would be when a patient comes to him who is unaware of his immanent spirit, for him it doesn't exist, and he's identified with a very large zone of painful turbulence, and the psychiatrist is supposed to know, but in general, if he's a Freudian, the immanent spirit doesn't exist for him either, and he's identified with the concept of the dynamics of psyche based on a 19th century view of the world and of evolution and so on. It's materialistic, it's not in the center, and this psychiatrist, the Freudian, is going to look at the patient from his own point of view. And the result will be that because he's not aware of the inner center in himself, he cannot become I-thou to the other being. His concept won't let him. So if the patient now starts arguing with him, because he doesn't think that there is an immanent spirit in the patient, he thinks the patient is arguing with him, And he can actually do something he's not supposed to, even in theory. He can get annoyed with the resistance of the patient. He can actually shout at the patient and say, you just don't want to accept the treatment. Now this actually occurs. There are psychiatrists who argue with their patients and try to convict them of resistance, not knowing that this resistance can never come from intelligence, because the intelligence itself in the center has only the will to make a whole out of its being. And therefore, whenever there is reactivity and resistance to health, it can never come from the person. If you think it does, you identify the person with the problem, the superstress tension, and you then proceed to condemn the person for being ill, and it is the illness that brought him to you. Now, if we understand this in ordinary human relations, we can say this. If you can get into a relation of immanent spirit to immanent spirit with another person, their somatic reaction to you is a matter of no moment. If there is loss of temper, resistance, irritability, and so on, you know that it can't be the intelligent center of that person that is so behaving. And consequently, you spontaneously forgive that behavior because it is mechanical and pain-driven. And it isn't the person. The person is not rejecting you. So if in a debate you make a statement out of your center, and as it's traversing the somatic zone of the other person, a reaction sets in, and he shouts back at you and says, rubbish, and as a matter of fact, all you've said is 2 and 2 is 4. Instead of thinking that the person has disagreed with you, rejecting your person, and then going into identification in your soma, you keep yourself out of it, know that you've stimulated by some word some painful record within that being, and that the record is reacting. So then you penetrate again to the center, you apologize for the disturbance caused, and try to discover the trigger word. If you both work together in this way, you can unlock these reactive zones. And remember what Tolstoy said, we've said it many times before, when a surgeon operates on somebody, he uses an anesthetic. When people are operating on each other's souls, they need an anesthetic. He said the anesthetic for a soul operation is love. If you love somebody, really love them, then their reactivity is of no account. You know that all reactivity, all aggression, all resistance is pathological. There's something the matter with it. The cells have been injured. A cell cannot react unintelligently unless it has been hurt. Every cell in the body has a function, and it does that function perfectly unless it is hurt. But if it has been hurt, it is on guard. And its on guardness will make it defend itself. And because it's on guard, it's put a wall around itself. And because it's put a wall around itself, it is in the dark. So the active self-defense is the same thing as the active self-induced blindness. We have then a very good method of helping each other to escape the hidden persuaders. That is to say, we watch each other's reactivity. We never identify the reactivity with the person. And when we think that we have discovered something to which another person is reactive, then in love we tell them that we think we have observed a certain kind of reaction. And if we have the right feeling when we tell them, it will be acceptable. But if we have the wrong feeling when we say it, it will be an attack. So if our motive is perfect, we can say anything. And if our motive is to injure or to be superior to the other person, then the tone that comes out isn't quite right, and it goes into the somatic zone, produces resonances. In effect, it is an attack. So it is only in this fact of the perfectly pure motive that goes from center to center that we can dodge the results of reactive argument. Any 5 minute point to raise?
These unconscious determinants where you have pleasure or pain in feeling has built a wall around an idea or a reaction. Are they the things that determine the karmic path of rich people?
Yes, yes. If you remember that karma itself, which means action and reaction, differs from karma only by the insertion of the R. Karma means desire, is the Hindu eros. And karma means the rulership of desire. You can see immediately that this ka, K function, and this ma, M function, closing activity, substantial activity. The closure is the same thing as desiring, appropriating substance. Karma, I take to myself this substance. It is the Hindu god of love. The love of appropriation, the love of possessive urge, the love that says you shall be mine and nobody else's. But as soon as it has made a closure, it has created for itself a zone differentiated from other zones, and therefore it's gone under periodic law. So we insert the R into it. It then goes closure, differentiation of substance. And that is the law of karma. Every time you close something, it will be opened later. Because if it's closed in time, it must be opened in time. That which is eternally closed or eternally open will remain so. But that which is opened in time must close in time. And that which is closed in time must open in time. So the law of karma is the law of appropriation of substances, or the desire, Cupid, little god of love that desires. So the whole of the karma of a person is the desires of that person in their totality, determining the mode of differentiation of that person out of the wisdom sphere. It takes him out of absolute equilibrium, precipitates him into a serial process of action, and thus exposes him to serial stimuli which disequilibrate him in specific ways determined by the original desires in which he indulged himself, so that he must always receive back from the equilibrated sphere the results of the peculiar kind of disequilibrium that he affirmed.
These small determinants that you have, are they subsidiary to 12 major determinants? And are they the things that you are working to control in the labors of Hercules?
Yes, or in the symbolism of the zodiac, if you like.
Well, see, or all in these things are divided into 12, aren't they? The tribe, disciples, labors.
Yes, that's based on the fourfold man, the three-part man, and the coordinator. Subdivided again. The 12 arises from 3, 3, 3. There's our 3, 3, 3. And the coordinator has also 3. A part that deals with the head, a part that deals with the chest, and a part that deals with the belly. So the 12 arise from the 3, being simply 3 times 4. And the 4th again is the 10th. Once you get that mystical word, 120. Which is very important in certain periodic law. In other words, if you like, you can place everything to which you are reactive somewhere in this 12-fold man. And by 12-fold man, you mean the 3-fold man, with his 3 parts divided into 3 parts, and his coordinator divided into 3 parts. Because there's coordination by intellect, coordinating my feeling, coordinating my will. And if you place these round the zodiac, you rediscover the symbolism of the 12 signs.